And the court will proceed to the second case of the day, the United States versus Mark Helfand. Mr. Scorza.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I've taken on the task of trying to persuade the court that the jury's finding attorney Mark Helfand guilty under count 7 of the indictment was an unreasonable finding. In particular, our argument is that that no reasonable jury could find the requisite intent of the fraud beyond a reasonable doubt. Of course, that's a tall order. In this case, the order may be a little shorter, if I might put it that way. The jury did find Mr. Helfand not guilty of 11 of the 12 counts charged. That's not determinative, of course, but it is significant in a case like this where there was one charged fraud and each of the counts of the indictment charged in chronological order simply and given alleged incidents of the fraud.
That kind of cuts two ways, though, because the jury was very discerning on requiring a high degree of evidence before they were going to convict on any of the counts, and opposed count 7 as a...
It certainly suggests, I would agree, that there was something particular about count 7 that led them to that count out of the 12. One further little red flag, however, for the court is that the trial judge, who, of course, saw all the witnesses and heard all the evidence and looked at all the documents in the sentencing process, the trial judge specifically found that Mr. Helfand had committed no criminal conduct at all in the acquitted counts, despite the fact, or what's interesting about that fact, I should say, is that the counts were indistinguishable with respect to Mr. Helfand's conduct, with the exception of one aspect about count 7.
$27,000.
Exactly, which is why we frontally put out there that that's the problem for Mr. Helfand, what I called the, and what was called at the trial, the circular transaction. In that transaction, which happened between January 12th and January 20th of the year 2000, Mr. Helfand conducted a series of banking transactions at his own business bank, whereby a $27,000 deposit was put into an account in the name of the buyer of the Count 7 property, Lisa McGill, with the result that the business bank generated a verification of deposit for that amount. Now, out of context and read superficially, that evidence is damning, and it's it's behind Your Honor's question, because it shows Mr. Helfand doing something, but that's dishonest. That's the way it looks, out of context and superficially. But human beings do not act out of context, and I don't mean anything sophisticated about that. Well, all I mean is let's look closely at what the situation is as of January 12th, when Mr. Helfand goes into his bank, draws a $27,000 check on his wife and his own account, and buys the cashier's check in the name of Lisa McGill. As of that day, five of the transactions charged in the indictment had already been conducted, with Mr. Helfand being the closing attorney. Five were completed. They all happened before January 12th of 2000. In every single one of those five transactions, every single one, there was no down payment paid by the buyer. The government says on page 17 of its brief, it specifies that in three of those counts, three of those transactions that happened before January 12th, the agent of Flagstar Bank, Law Title Company, the closing agent, itself engineered the no down payment transaction by an accounting entry on one hand and writing itself a check on the other to pay the down payment supposedly to come from the buyer. That's happened before Mr. Helfand walked into his bank on January 12th. In the other two counts, it's even more interesting. Count one, no down payment was paid at all by anybody, the government says, and the government is right, which means Flagstar's agent, which was Law Title Company, allowed that transaction to go through, approved that transaction, knowing full well that there was no down payment paid by the buyer. The only one missing of the first five transactions is transaction number two, or the one charged in count two. That transaction involves a property on South Drexel Avenue. It's an odd transaction because the seller was Dawn Brantley Jackson and the buyer was Jacqueline Jackson, her mother. And so it was a sort of a fake transaction to begin with. In that transaction, it looks like Mr. Helfin did, in fact, provide the down payment, did instruct Law Title to give him the reimbursement, but it appears that Law Title made a mistake and paid the reimbursement check to Dawn Brantley by mistake. It's exactly the same kind of check as the others. It's the amount of the down payment plus a round number accommodation fee, in that case, $400. My point is that you don't have to stretch. The only possible inference that could be drawn by any human being participating in those five transactions that happened before January 12th is that the bank's agent was conducting all these transactions as down payment, no down payment transactions. Whatever program these loans were in the bank, the bank's agent was conducting them, accepting them, in fact, engineering them as no down payment transactions. On January 19th, the one day when the amount is in the checking account, on that day, oddly enough, the transaction in count six takes place. Mr. Helfin, again, is the closing attorney. That count six transaction is conducted just the way the count seven transaction is conducted. Mr. Helfin provides a check from his company to pay the down payment. At the end of the transaction, Mr. Helfin receives the funds back plus an accommodation fee, the standard one, $350. So in the six transactions that happened before the count seven transactions, in every single one of them, the down payment was paid for the buyer, by the seller or by a accounting transaction engineered by the bank's agent.
You don't deny here that this was a pretty significant fraud that was being...
No question.
By the Jacksons.
Did
you say that Mr. Helfin, as an attorney, played no role at all and was no idea what was going on?
He was not part of the fraud, is what I'm saying. As he understood it, the Jacksons were very capable in obtaining these distressed properties, sometimes out of foreclosure, sometimes because they were half falling down. He was providing lawyer services for them to conduct those transactions.
Well, like in count seven, that property, I think, was off on the numbers here, but I thought it was something in the area of $30,000, and then a week later, $85,000.
Well, a week later, it's purchased for $30,000. The Jacksons put a fraudulent price on it of $85,000, but everybody knows, remember, that no one's going to pay $85,000. What's going to be paid is the mortgage amount. So that property is actually sold to Lisa McGill, as opposed to $60,000.
But even 30 to 65 or so.
Well, Judge,
8 days.
But it's a time in which that is happening all over the city, and especially on the south side, place close to me, and that, I should say. The property values are soaring. It's actually the thing behind, I think, the bank's thinking. The reason the bank has
become... They're not doubling in 8 days on the south side of Chicago.
But that assumes, Your Honor, that the $30,000 is not a great buy by the Jacksons. Every single one of their transactions appears to be... In fact, we found out at sentencing. I wasn't the trial lawyer in the case, but the sentencing hearing revealed that in 60% of all of the cases... Of all of the instances in which the bank had lent to the Jacksons, in 60% of them, the buyers managed to pay off the mortgage in full, apparently because they sold the property or refinanced it. It's an indication that what was happening is, in that circumstance, properties values were inflating very quickly, and that if you were clever, if you knew what you were doing, you could get in low and sell high and sell very quickly. Now, the important point to me is, that when he goes in there and does this transaction, which I can assure you he wished he had never done, he knows that the transactions are all going to be done as no down payment transactions. And that explains, and is the only thing that can explain, the way he does the transaction. That transaction is done with no concealment whatsoever. There's no cash transaction, so on. I was a prosecutor a long time. I would have loved to have found some cash going in that account or cash coming out of the account because it's the first thing I would have pointed to the jury. Instead, Mr. Helfin goes in there using his own bank account in his own bank, and he opens up an account. And what kind of an account? An IOLTA account. We all say IOLTA. That account is a lawyer trust account. It's not part of the record, but it's part of our common experience as Illinois attorneys. It's been required since the early 1980s. In order to open up that kind of account, you fill out a special form. It's a form for that account. You identify yourself as a lawyer, and you put the funds that are either nominal or short-term funds for a client. And the important thing about the account, of course, is any interest earned, it's a NOW type of account, goes to the lawyer trust fund, and therefore that's the tax number on the account. Mr. Helfand, unembarrassedly, with no concealment, fills out the form, opens that account for the purpose of putting in the $27,000 for that one day to generate the verification of deposit. It just makes no sense, Judge, that a lawyer who, by the government's lights, is in there engaged in a major fraud, is going in there and being fastidious about the Illinois bar rule. The guy who's running away from the bank robbery is not the guy waiting for the light to change green before he crosses. He is behaving as a man who's has no fraudulent intent, is doing nothing wrong. And why? This is the embarrassing part about the case for the banking system, and we're reading about it every day. Why? The bank wants the document, the verification of the deposit. Certainly. It definitely wants that document to put it in its file. But the bank does not care about the substance of the document, because everyone knows that when the transaction is going to be completed, Lisa McGill is going to pay no down payment. The down payment is going to be paid by the seller.
And well, there's a lengthy transcript here, and of course we haven't really read that yet. But you describe Mr. Helfand as a North suburban downtown lawyer who had little knowledge about what was going on in the south side of Chicago. How did he get together with the Jacksons here in the first instance?
Does
the record tell us?
Yes, Your Honor. And I described it in my brief. It's background facts, obviously. He first began doing closings for Dawn Jackson. Through her, he was introduced to the other two. They started doing heavy-duty transactions, real estate transactions on the south side. This is a case, by the way, in which these south-siders are taking this Northbrook lawyer to the cleaners because they are regularly borrowing large amounts of money from him. They're supposed to pay back with allegedly a high fee, and in many cases, they never paid at all. These are smart street people. They were caught up in a drug transaction, the junior ones, and paid the penalty for that and tried to lower the sentence by testifying against Mr. Helfand. The critical thing is that there's no doubt that the Mr. Helfand's intent is the important issue, and you cannot come up with a fraudulent intent when you put the transaction in context. Let me just conclude by saying, because I see my white lights on, when the transaction is completed, Mr. Helfand gets nothing except his regular fees. Believing that an attorney would participate in a fraud in return for his fees is like believing that a cab driver will be the getaway guy in a bank robbery in return for the fee on the meter with no tip. It just does not happen in the real world.
Mr. Helfand's out on bond pending appeal?
Yes, Your Honor. The government did not oppose the bond.
You know what the findings are required to do that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government, then.
Thank you, Mr. Scalia.
Thank you.
Mr. Havey?
Can I address that question to you? He's out on bond pending appeal. The government didn't oppose it, and usually there's a requirement as to likelihood of success on appeal, right?
First of all, Judge Caney, good morning, Judge Flom, and Judge Evans. That's correct, Your Honor, and we didn't oppose it not because we were expressing some view on the merits of the case. I mean, I hoped that what I was doing was the correct thing and that he received a five-month jail sentence. I didn't want to presuppose the outcome of the case, and the briefing alone, Judge, brought us, would have taken us through that five.
I understand.
That was the only reason I agreed to that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
To Judge Evans, your question about whether the defendant played any role at all in the scheme, what I would say is this is a crime that would not have been completed without his involvement, without his knowing involvement. He could have stopped it at any point if he wanted to, but he did not put on the brakes, I would submit, because he had a financial stake in the outcome of the case. Now, Mr. Scorza said he didn't make anything. He got taken to the cleaners. He actually, by his own admission, made $238,000, which he, I say by his own admission, in the settlement agreement that he had with Flagstar Bank, he settled for $238,000, which he characterized as the amount of his profits on these deals. And his stake in these deals.
What? It's an unusual verdict when the jury acquits on so many, over 90% of the counts, and convicts on only one. I assume that you had relatively the same kind of evidence, didn't you, on all? Why don't you just charge him? If count seven was such a strong count as compared to the other ones, why don't you just have him indicted on one count?
We could have, Your Honor, but as even Mr. Scorza pointed out, I don't think that count was distinguishable from the others, save that one transaction where he opened this bank account for the victim. All of these transactions were conducted in the same manner. And to charge him with one count where the evidence in our judgment reflected that this was a larger scheme, these transactions were indistinguishable in my judgment. I'm puzzled by the jury's verdict, Your Honor, and I'm not going to try and get into their heads and offer speculation about why they did what they did, but in my judgment, these, I don't know how you could say on in the middle, count seven, he knew there was a fraud going on. He was a knowing participant in this fraud scheme. But the day before and the day after, those two transactions, he did not know. That puzzles me, Your Honor. His stake in all of these deals, as I was saying, is not just seeing that he gets paid his services, his legal fees, as part of the attorney-client relationship. He had a stake, a financial stake, in the proceeds of these sales. He selected the closing company where these transactions took place. I think that's a point which even Mr. Scorza would concede, and I think he makes that point in his brief. And he used his relationship with this closing company to get these deals closed.
Is there a particular added financial reward for him for that action?
He had, his relationship was as was set out in the complaint that the bank filed as a title examiner. Through that, he could generate smaller fees for conducting title examinations. And the bank or the closing company, of course, got to know him over time. He was in there on a monthly basis, more often than a monthly basis. And the representative from the title company, LaShawn Hill, who was managing the office, said they knew him and they trusted him. And that's why they did these, what even she admitted were out of the ordinary deals, Your Honor. Mr. Scorza used the term engineered deals, and I think that's a correct characterization. These deals were engineered, and they were engineered at his direction. The closing company did not do this on their own. He asked them to do it, and it was an accommodation, yes. They were accommodating his request. He was on both sides of these engineered real estate deals. And Mr. Scorza wants to talk about putting this in context, of course. That's what we should do. We start with these loan contracts that he asked the Jacksons to sign. This is where it all starts. Of course, signing a contract is a lawful act. But what I'll say about what he's doing here is he's protecting himself. He's protecting his, what I said was a financial stake in these property deals. And let me just make two observations about these loan contracts. First is, while he's writing a contract protecting himself, we don't see a contract between the seller, the Jacksons, and these people are being duped, the buyers. We don't see a contract between the Jacksons and the buyers saying that they're going to pay back the Jacksons for this down payment, this non-existent down payment, which he fronts, which I'm going to mention in a minute. We don't see any contract there, and this is exactly what happened in the Jaffe case that we cite in our brief. It references these seller carryback loans which don't have to be repaid. And that's a farce and it's a fraud, because what he's doing is rewriting the loan contract. He's rewriting the terms of the loan without the lender's knowledge. We're basically writing 30% of the value of the sale price off the top. The bank now is losing what equity was supposed to be there. Their protection is now gone. Instead of funding what they think is a loan which is equal to 70% of the value of the property, they're now funding 100% of the value of the property, only they don't know it. And that's what happened in the Jaffe case, and it was found to be a fraud. The other thing I would say about these loan contracts, Your Honor, is the time period that they covered. Very short. Typically, the Jacksons were required to sell these properties within 30 days, or they had to repay the loans within 30 days. I saw a couple examples in the appendix that Mr. Scorza filed showing that I think that they had to repay the loans within 7 days. And that kind of thing encourages fraud, as you mentioned, Judge, because we're talking 7, 8 days apart. Obviously, the property cannot be fixed up and rehabbed, especially the condition that this particular property was in. It can't be rehabbed within that period of time, and he knew that they weren't going to rehab it. They were borrowing money from him just to buy it. So where was the money going to come from to raise the value of this property up another $50,000 to its sale price of $85,000?
Mr. Havey, do you tie Mr. Helfand to the false appraisals? Or are they?
He did not ask the Jacksons, as far as I know, to inflate the appraisals. He did not write the appraisals. But what I would say is that he knew the value of the property was inflated. I mean, after all, that's the only way the Jacksons are going to be able to pay him back. They've got to pay back the money that he's loaning them to buy it. They've got to pay back his loan fee and any excess fees, $1,000 a week thereafter. They've got to pay the closing costs. So now it's got to be inflated at least that much. Of course, if they want to make a profit on top of that, it's got to be inflated even more. And he knows all this, whether or not he's preparing the appraisal. Of course he did not. But he had to know that it was inflated.
And just because a reasonable person would know the market wouldn't support that price? Is that the assumption the government makes?
Well, yes, sir. And as Judge Evans pointed out, yeah, inflating very quickly in Mr. Scores' words, but 100% in 8 days, I don't think so. Count one, which he makes a big point about. This is the one where they bought property on day one for $25,000 and sold it the next day for $75,000. And that's why that count was charged, Your Honor. I mean, no, we want to talk about what a reasonable person could find. How could a reasonable person not look at that and think that there was something wrong here going on? And yes, the title company was negligent. You know, they should have done a better job. That's perhaps why we're in the mess we're facing today. Part of one of the reasons is they were too lax back then. But that doesn't mean they knew what was going on. We get to the closing, and Mr. Helfand is writing these down payment checks. You know, again, we're talking about context, Your Honor. He says in his argument, this is all transparent. And the question I would say to that, raised to that, is transparent to whom? The title company, first of all, they're not a group of investigators that go out and look behind the numbers and see, are these people telling the truth on their loan applications? Is Mr. Helfand receiving money from the buyer that supports this check he's writing? They assume he's upholding the integrity of the transaction. Their job is to basically make sure that the buyer and the seller are who they say they are, show me an ID, make sure they sign everything. That's what they do. They follow instructions. And they made a mistake of following his instructions. That's what got us into this big mess. Transparent to the bank. Certainly it was not transparent to the bank. The bank, what they see is a settlement statement, and this down payment is buried in there, and the repayment to him that happens at the table is characterized as a payoff of a second mortgage. Now, he may blame that again on the title company, and perhaps it is their fault, but again, it's being misrepresented to the lender as a loan. There was no loan. Mr. Helfand knew that. Lisa McGill didn't have a loan agreement with him, as I mentioned. He has a loan agreement with the Jacksons. There's no loan agreement between him and Miss McGill. He knew she wasn't paying the down payment. He met her for the first time at the closing, and yet he writes this check. This attorney representing the seller, what's he doing writing a check for the buyer? And then we get to the worst part of all, which is this this distinguishing transaction of count seven, which we characterized as a charade in our brief, and I believe that's what it is, Judge, Your Honors. He takes out this cashier's check. Somebody forges Lisa McGill's signature. We don't know who. Somebody does. Not Mr. Helfand, somebody else. He deposits it. He's making an issue about what kind of an account it is. Frankly, it doesn't matter what kind of an account it is, IOLTA or anything out, anything else. The false pretense is that it's not her money. He's putting a cashier's check in that has a forged signature on it, gets a verification of deposit, and then closes the account the next day. That's a complete facade. And for somebody who wants to tout his 30 years of experience in the real estate industry, which he does, and then constructs this facade and expects the jury to believe that now he's the dumbest guy in the room, basically, and he doesn't know what's happening around him. The jury did not have to buy that, and they didn't. And we think the jury's verdict is supported by ample evidence and should be upheld. I will not address the sentencing issue because Mr. Scorza didn't, but if there are any comments or questions, I will.
Say just one question. Did you mention that there was a financial reward of $238,000?
It's not if I characterize it as a financial reward.
Well, no, that may be my words. I don't want to put them in your. You should phrase it as whatever it was. I just want to understand clearly what you're talking about.
And he was, and this is all in the record. These are exhibits that were part of the sentencing. When he was sued by the bank, it did not go to trial. He settled it. They drafted a settlement agreement, and Mr. Helfand, his wife, and his company, being financial, settled with the bank for the sum of $238,000. In the settlement agreement, it provided that, and maybe I'm misquoting this, that these funds represented, I think, the gross proceeds that he received from these real estate deals that were at issue in this case. I raise that, Your Honor, only in response to the argument that he was basically taken to the cleaners. To point out that by his own admission, he made at least that much. Thank you. We would, of course, request that the judgment, the verdict of the jury, and the sentence of the court be upheld.
Thank you, Mr. Havey. Mr. Scorza?
Judge, their own witness acknowledged from the law title company that her superiors approved every one of these transactions. She said that point blank. That's the agent of Flagstar Bank. Mr. Helfand does not deal, never dealt directly with Flagstar Bank. The agent is approving these transactions. Everyone is being conducted in exactly the same way. And everyone in the room is sophisticated. The law title company, which takes Mr. Helfand's instructions, Mr. Helfand says, I've paid the down payment. I've been repaid for the down payment. Law title company puts that on the settlement statement as a second mortgage payment. That's their decision, not Mr. Helfand's. Your Honor should look closely at the settlement statements for count six and count seven. The settlement statement's identification of the second mortgage amount is almost exactly the same amount as the payment of the down payment that was due, the amount of the down payment was due. Anyone in the field, any banker receiving that settlement statement, and the bank got every single one of them, would be able to tell instantaneously that this was a transaction in which the seller was paying the down payment. What are the odds that the second mortgage on all these houses just happened to be almost exactly equal down to the pennies to the amount due from the borrower? The bank knew full well, its agent knew full well. By the way, I quoted the relevant law of agency. Mr. Helfand divulged everything to the agent. And under the law of agency, that means he divulged it to the principal, who's Flagstar. More important than the law of agency is the underlying reason for it. A man in Helfand's position has only one assumption that he can make, that the agent is operating on behalf of the principal. The government did not charge Law Title Company with being a part of the conspiracy. The bank apparently didn't complain about Law Title Company misleading it. And that's because no matter how they want to spin it now, back in those days, and it led to the prison crisis that we read about every day, the banks were promiscuous. These loans were being made to anybody. And when after the loan was made, the bank was depending upon that quickly inflating market to save itself. It didn't work, obviously, for the banks. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Scorsese. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And the